before we start the podcast, I want to tell you about something else that's been going on, which is that I've been writing, along with my partner Anna Mill, a comic book called Square Eyes, which is finally, after about 7 years of work, finally reaching publication. It's a science fiction set in a sort of near future filled with augmented reality, kind of strangely altered cities and places. It's very beautiful, which I can say because I didn't draw any of the pictures.
It's got extremely good illustrations, and lots of them.
It's coming out at the start of October, but you can pre-order now. The website is squareeyescomic.com, and we've got links on there as well as some examples of the sorts of things that you'll find inside. So if that sounds like it might be your sort of thing, please go and have a look. Also, remember that we've got Patreon at patreon.com/about_buildings, where for $3 a month you can receive bonus content with every episode. On this episode's bonus, we're going to be talking about the Gothic revival in architecture before and after Ruskin. Since first the dominion of men was asserted over the ocean, three thrones, of mark beyond all others, have been set upon its sands, the thrones of Tyre, Venice, and England. Of the first of these great powers, only the memory remains. Of the second, the ruin. The third, which inherits their greatness, if it forget their example, may be led through prouder eminence to less pitied destruction. The exaltation, the sin, and the punishment of Tyre have been recorded for us. Her successor, like her in perfection of beauty, though less in endurance of dominion, is still left for our beholding in the final period of her decline, a ghost upon the sands of the sea, so weak, so quiet, so bereft of all but her loveliness, that we might well doubt, as we watched her faint reflection in the mirage of the lagoon, which was the city and which was the shadow.
Well, that's quite enough of that. We're going to talk on what I'm sure will be one of your favourite topics, big bearded Victorian John Ruskin, who wrote extremely long book The Stones of Venice, which we will cover most of in part two of this. Part one, we're going to cover life, works, situation, and the boring first 40% of the volume.
Yes, the great book itself. You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities, by the way. I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Gingell.
And John Ruskin's Stones of Venice is one of the great monuments of 19th century architectural writing.
It's so big.
Big. It's big. And not only for being very big. I think in talking about Ruskin, there are some issues which we're going to try to address, which make him inherently a little bit challenging. There can be a tendency to maybe harvest whatever seems kind of convenient or interesting from him, leaving the rest within the background, whether that be kind of nice poetic aphorisms on the dignity of labour or weird tales of Victorian sexuality. And so we're going to take quite a long route to Venice in order to decode what's really at work, to read the different ocean currents which are sort of swirling around. It's going to require quite a lot of context of him, his time, of the Victorians, of the sort of particular estuary that he's paddling around in.
One of the quite fun things about this is the 19th century is one of the big centuries.
One of the main ones.
It's one of the big centuries, but it's also one that feels very distant. These people do not have our attitudes. They don't think like us. They just seem to have such a prodigious amount of time on their hands. He sort of lived roughly almost exactly the same time as Queen Victoria, born in 1819 and died around the turn of the century.
Yeah, so he's almost an exact contemporary in birth and death, isn't he?
But also of a number of other hairy, well, sort of clean-shaven in youth, hairy in old age, Victorian writers, Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin, Karl Marx. Can you think of any other ones? I mean, these are all sort of contemporaries within 3 or 4 years.
They went to Beards. It was
they did. There's always charming pictures of them young, often before they've been trousered, sort of in
smiling sweetly,
smiling cherubs, looking rather and then there'll be a sort of dashing young portrait as a,
and then the one of them is a very old man with his kind of like Methuselah beard draped over the paint, the sort of the papers scattered on the desk,
and they are all marked by, at least looking from the outside, terrific seriousness, one of the great characteristics of the age, which is a word that is very loaded. And they're all sort of taught, all those three people, you get, they're on the curriculum at school, I'd imagine, in most places, that are teaching in English.
Yeah.
Like, that might not actually be expected to read them.
No.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah, I don't know how much Ruskin gets, you know.
Well, people should know who he is anyway. And they were all very influential, but they're also all not someone who... Does anyone read any of those people?
What, Karl Marx? Yeah, people read Karl Marx.
They do. God, a lot more people say they do than actually do. I guess the reason for me saying that is that it's sort of trying to reach back and unpick a period that is really daunting.
Yes.
Looking at it from the outside.
It's strange. And I think also that often the way in which someone like Ruskin will be interpreted is in a way trying to pick out the things which make him relevant or the things which make him palatable. And I think that there's lots of great stuff in there, but we're not going to be doing that. I think we're going to be trying to give a more sort of rounded view of what it's really like.
Trying to get into the mind. It's another reason it's interesting if you're living in London, which about 96% of you aren't, is that the ground state around here is Victorian. Bricks of London, the churches, the terrace houses, they're not so much the architecture of London as the ground of London. There's a lot of other stuff about, but in between, it's always within a matrix of Victorian background.
His parents really are a very Victorian sort of type, in the sense that they're like bourgeois evangelicals, basically, aren't they?
His mother. So his grandfather on his dad's side was born into a prosperous, what at the time would have been called grocer, which means wholesale sort of food importer, but was somewhat mad, prone to episodes of mental breakdown, and ineffective, and I think his father's upbringing was very hard, and he took a bit to the church. His mother was from somewhat hotter sort of evangelical, and they were very respectable people, and she was really into God. And he got in with a couple of friends and set up a business importing mainly sherry, and became very, very honourable, noble trade, the sherry importer, and became very successful. And in fact, probably... what's the brand? Do you want to just check it? But anyway, I've temporarily forgotten the name, but it's still probably the second biggest brand of sherry in the UK.
The firm was called Ruskin, Telford and Domecq, and I think it's now Allied Domecq PLC, an international spirits and wine company.
Do you think
company.
That could be pronounced Domecq? Domecq? I think it's that. Anyway, big sherry brand, and he did very well, really rescuing the family's fortunes and propelling them into sort of haute bourgeois. Yeah. Not like prodigiously rich or anything, but very, very comfortable. Certainly having portraits painted and a nice big house in London and a nice house in Edinburgh. They had him quite late. Yeah. I think his mother may have been 40 or in her late 30s when they had their first child, which was the first and only child, Ruskin?
Yeah, like 38.
Not remarkable today, but I think quite old then to have your first child. And I think it was a very, very close, quite loving, well, very loving, but quite strict family with quite old parents.
So he was sort of, he was a wealthy, precocious, clever only child, very much kind of enveloped in God and family.
Also, his father was a great collector of paintings and drawings, big buyer of the art of the day, early adopter of Turner, many Turner drawings and paintings collected by, like, dozens, maybe hundreds.
Mm.
And they would be, you know, he'd buy them at auction, be very proud of the price, show it off, talk to his son about it. And I think he regarded his son as a real prodigy.
Yeah.
Intellectually. He was going to be a poet.
As parents tend to do.
A poet or a bishop or... Yeah. I don't know. I it's not universal.
I don't know. I would say it's pretty widespread.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so he was going to be a poet or a bishop or change the world. And the other thing is that the family... From the time of his youth, started taking trips, initially to the romantic picturesque of the Lake District to go up and see Thelmere, just as Wordsworth was whinging about all the madding crowds going there and disturbing the peace. And then slowly his travel opened up to France, the great cathedrals, to see the Alps, like the Romantics, and Italy. And he got to Venice for the first time, age 16, which would have been, I mean, that's in the late 1830s.
Yeah, mid-1830s.
Mid-1830s. Yeah. So this is really...
Everyone had cholera.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much the Ancien Régime. It's still an island at that point under Austrian rule, but very much... I think you would have got a strong sense of what it was like under the Republic, the old Venetian Republic, which had only fallen, you know, 30, 40 years before in living memory. And comes back, studies at Oxford, or goes down to Oxford. His mother moved down to be close to him.
Oh yeah, this is a bit of a tale, isn't it? Well, he's living with his mother all the way through university.
Yes.
Hmm.
Does he have a nervous breakdown? I probably should have read the biography or something beforehand. He suffers rather like his grandfather from initially rarely, but then with increasing frequency, bouts of insanity.
Yeah, I think he had fears of, like, illness. He fell in love with a girl, and then, you know, classic stuff. Yeah,
pretty familiar experience of lots of people going to university. Went away, came back, I think after quite a lot of years. The university thought that he was good enough to sort of give him an honorary fourth class degree.
Yes, he sat for a pass degree and was awarded an uncommon honorary double fourth class degree, which is not a kind of degree that you can get nowadays.
I mean, that's an extremely bad degree as well.
What's double fourth class? It's double fourth class. So is that, yeah.
I think that's like, you're a thoroughly good sort and have clearly got some sort of head on your shoulders, but haven't done any of the work, haven't attended any lectures, and can't answer any of the questions.
It's this wonderful, like, it's sort of blend of what seems to be like heightening qualifiers. But and then like the fourth class, like the uncommon and the double.
It's like the formerly the Premier Conference, as we used to have, which is the,
oh, yeah,
which for a long time was the lowest national league in English football.
Yeah, like yeah. Yes, yeah, so it's first divisions all the way down, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
although I think that was called that because it was sponsored by Premier Inns.
So, I mean, he was writing very young. He actually wrote his children's book, The King of the Golden River, while he was at Oxford.
We should give some context for that later, I think.
Strange one, yeah. Well, which, I think, for a long time was his most successful book.
By sales, but I don't think by influence at all.
No, which is a sort of moralistic children's story. And
which were very popular. If you look at the like early editions of the Railway Library or something, there's an awful lot of sort of soft fable-orientated spiritual and moral autobiography and moralising stories for children being written at this time. I know we like to fixate on Varney the Vampire, but most of the books being published were these absolutely tedious, allegorically Christian moralising books.
It was an age of moralising and of sentimentality.
Yeah, and seriousness.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, so kind of, yeah, or at least they thought it was.
Yes, yeah. Oscar Wilde would be satirising when he said it would take someone with a heart of stone not to laugh at the death of Nell, which is the cute innocent character in. Is she in David Copperfield?
Oliver Twist, isn't it?
Isn't it the innocent girl in Little Nell who's like leading her grandfather like around maybe. To save him and slowly sickens and dies?
Well, maybe, yeah. No, I've probably
in
got
a sort
confused.
Of angelic
yeah.
scene.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, no, that sounds very plausible.
Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, don't trust. This is exactly the sort of background material which, if we researched, would never get anything done, ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we've just got to read all of Dickens as
a little aside. I mean, I'm sure it's worth doing.
Yeah, so modern painters, when he came out of Oxford, he wrote a book called Modern Painters, and it, I think, is a bit of a model for what motivates him as a writer, in the sense that it's a little bit like the contemporary of phenomenon of someone is wrong on the internet, and therefore I'm going to, you know, write an, some kind of enormous screed, or, I don't know, send them an email telling them I'm going to kill them, or whatever. But, in you know, John Ruskin's particular method of sublimation is to write the first volume of what would become a 5-volume work, which he was working on.
Or... Or 9-volume, because he also said that it was the same books as the 7 Lamps of Architecture and the Stones of Venice.
Oh, right, they all joined together. Oh, well, then that's 10, I think. Yeah. No, 9, yeah, you're right, yeah.
The volumes are often not short as well.
So the motivation is that, that at that time, a group of artists and art critics were being highly critical of the work of J.M.W. Turner, who we've already referred to, who's the you know one of the great landscape painters of the era, and who has this very characteristic, atmospheric, blurry style. Just Google it if you've never seen it before. I mean, he's a very famous painter.
It was becoming more and more abstract as his career went on. He was by this time in his late career.
Yeah, and they are
he's very good, Turner.
Yeah, he's officially good. I mean, he's one of the artists, as we'll see later, there are plenty of artists of that era who don't really including lots who Ruskin really liked, who really have not
haven't made the cut.
They don't read in the same way at all now, but Turner certainly does. And yeah, they're these amazing, like, sort of swirling, colourful atmospheres, often within which there will be one or two kind of identifiable elements which will then kind of create the reading of the landscape or whatever. You know, the famously there'll be like the train hurtling across the viaduct, or
he's extremely interested also in modernity.
Yeah,
he's painting in the 1830s, right at the beginning, steam trains, steamboats,
or famously the old, the old ship being broken up. These kind of being taken away to be broken
the
up.
Fighting Temeraire.
So he's being Turner's being criticised for and compared unfavourably with the artists of with Titian, basically, with those kind of artists and the way in which they used colour. And the way, and all sorts of aspects of the kind of representation and craft and things. So that's the motivation, basically, for the book, which takes the form of, it's kind of a polemic about, well, what is art anyway? What is truth in painting? What's the difference between being good at painting in the sense of using lines and colour and various things to depict accurately, and something more like the sort of poetry of representation where you communicate poignantly these ideas which move the viewer, and kind of breaking all of these things down in a sense in order to make the argument that actually you're all wrong, Turner's really good, which he eventually gets to sort of midway through volume one. I was having a little page through it, and it's very funny. Well, I'll leave you to decide whether it's funny or not, but the examples are striking. So he's getting onto this question of, yeah, this kind of distinction, which he compares to the distinction in poetry between being a poet and being a kind of a versifier. So someone who's able to, like, produce lots of copy.
And churn out quality doggerel, yeah.
So the example that he chooses to talk about is a painting by Edwin Landseer, called The Old Shepherd's Chief Mourner.
Isn't he like a late Georgian, early Victorian landscape painter and sort of painter of scenes?
He does, yeah, sort of scenes, and he's the godfather of Lutyens, hence the name, I believe, or possibly an uncle, I'm not really sure. And he describes this painting as one of the most perfect poems or pictures, I use the words as synonymous, which modern times have seen. Do you want to see it?
Yeah, let's have a look. Oh.
It's a picture of a dog.
It's a dog in a coffin.
And it's a picture of this.
There's like this. I'll describe the scene because you actually know what you're talking about. In the scene, we are in a dark and gloomy, poor domestic interior. In the middle, there is a large coffin with a rug over it and a dog looking mournfully, resting his chin on the coffin. And that's basically what the portrait is.
So his analysis is, you know, this the...
And there's some sort of olive leaves sprinkled about the place and lots of scenic detailing. There's a nice three-legged stool.
Lots of mise-en-scène. So that's basically the distinction he's making, is like being able to paint the fur to look like fur is one thing, but being able to characterise the dog and artistically scatter, you know, the Bible and the glasses and these other very moving details.
There's lots of symbolic moving details.
That's real art.
That's real art. This piece is... it's like... It could make a really good, weird jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, well, I hope someone has done it. I hope someone has done it.
It would be quite difficult because everything in it is essentially brown.
He goes into real rhapsodies about this, but it's... but he also... It's very, very Victorian, this, because it's so sentimental, this painting. It's so sentimental.
And I think this is something where we're really pointing to. Ruskin's taste... This is going to go all the way through. It's not impeccable.
No.
He likes some good stuff and some mediocre stuff and intensely dislikes some good stuff and some mediocre stuff. And some of the stuff he likes the most is not the stuff
that you would now sort of say
which
is...
you would now pick out as being
the
very best. He does have all the way through aesthetic insights, but they're not... He shouldn't be taken as an arbiter of taste. Who do you think would really love to have this painting of a coffin on their wall?
I don't know. Yeah, this poor little sad
dog. It's way sillier than even like the Monarch of the Glen, which when was that painted? That was so popular. Which is a painting of a Scottish stag. Yes, rather like with the painting of, you know, the barge going to the Isle of Death in Germany, like which adorned every wall. In print, that was one of the great English Victorian paintings.
Ruskin was very moved by these, you know, these kind of scenes or this kind of what seems to us to be like this incredibly sort of stagey or like hammy
kitsch.
Things. Yeah, it's kitsch.
It's like insanely kitsch.
There's no, yeah, yes. Anyway, so that's Modern Painters. He went on writing it over a long period. He would sort of do a volume every now and then. The fifth volume is really worth looking into, and I think has been kind of used quite a lot because, as with all his books, he sort of tries on different approaches. And in that one, he gets into his sort of thing is about how should you correctly paint various elements, and it's full of all of these rather beautiful pictures of leaves and clouds, which were him sort of trying to explain the way in which different things work or are kind of depictable.
But it's worth saying that I think we'll expand this more a little bit, but all of these are fitting within genres of his day. Yeah. It was quite common to write books that were essentially big pamphlets in dialogue with other people, but writing big pamphlets that the sort of literary society of the day would know the conversation. There also is a genre of people who write, this is the correct way to represent landscape for lots of people as a hobby, went out and drew the countryside. There's a very popular late 18th century book by a pastor who is also the popularizer of the clawed glass, which is this sort of oval black mirror that you're meant to take around and like examine, use it as a reflection to get your perfect composition.
Yeah,
sort
I,
of
know
like,
the, I know the one, but you I can't want, remember the name.
You want three cows, no more than three cows, mountains or clouds together. When there's a fourth one, it must be broken off into a separate group. Same with gypsies or peasants. It's all sort of replete with lines like that. And a really interesting thing about this book, written by someone who's just graduated late with a double fourth from Oxford, is that although it had quite a small and short run, selling a few hundred books, It was bought by a lot of the key intellectual literary figures of its age. It was bought by Jane Austen, Wordsworth, Turner himself, various other people. So, and it's remarkable that those people bought this guy who just come out of Oxford's book. Yep. It's a bit mysterious to me how that kind of happened. We had a little drink break. We've just said that, but I thought we'd do a quick summary of his times and the times of first half of the 19th century in England. At the end of the Napoleonic War, when he's born just after it finishes, England's been blocked off from continental markets and has, behind that barrier, taken over world trade and developed an extraordinary industrial economy, the like of which had never been seen. This is before steam trains and things, but lots of factories to supply the weapons. The economy had become extremely militarized. There'd also been a population explosion and enormous improvement in agriculture. The population explosion, in the context of the rural population staying about the same, had driven this enormous push of people into towns, huge growth in towns in the north, and huge growth of London and Bristol and places like that. After the end of the war, there's an economic shock, and we're very much in Georgian London, and it's a time of there's a sort of harbinger of what's going to happen. There's a bit of famine and hardship, and the 1820s are sort of a period of recovery. The 1830s are a period of growing tension in the country. We're starting to have the rollout of railways. It's just beginning and would really gather pace in the 1840s. The towns are growing. The conditions of working people are appalling. The life expectancy plummets in the industrial north. The system is really creaking because of this huge population expansion. Terrible sort of conditions in mines and mills. And political tension. It's called the Angry 30s. And that gives way to the Hungry 40s, when there's a series of, again, still exploding population, still enormous industrial expansion. The Corn Law issue is becoming this very big thing. The issue of the price of food, the interests of the landed aristocracy and the church, who are making huge amounts of money by controlling the price of food, keeping it expensive, which is the main cost of working people. And also the issue of expanding the franchise. There's a big pressure building with Chartism and the idea that really many more people should have the vote. There's worry about it's going to be another revolution. Aristocracy is still in control of loads of things. And there's a series of poor harvests. In fact, right across Europe in the early and mid 1840s, most famously, the potato blight, which caused so much tragedy in Ireland.
Killed like a million people.
It killed a million people and half the population because so many people left, and really was exacerbated enormously by the British government's policy and the policy of local Protestant landlords who were, throughout the 19th century, really very interested in turfing off Catholic smallholding tenants and putting more economic for them.
Yeah, sheep on
practices,
the yeah.
Sheep on it, and in an almost sort of colonial style. There was already and had been through the late 18th century a big political active reform movement based on reform in England. The key galvanizing issue, I think, actually is the abolition of slavery, which was accomplished in the British Empire in 1807, I think, and then across all sort of British dominions, and they Britain said it would attack anyone engaged in international slavery in 1830 something. But that, which is a sort of Christian, non-conformist Christian, literary, educated movement, and they are the same people who are very interested in the conditions of the poor, and it's being published, and there are reports, and it's in the air in literary society, as well as the fear of revolution, economic inequity, technological change, and shifts in religion as well. The religious debate is complicated. There'd sort of been, in the late 18th century, a big growth in evangelicalism in England, and probably a growth in the number of people attending churches on the back of that, and a big growth in nonconformism and the various sort of, you know, the churches splintering even more. At the time that he's young, you're beginning to get the Tractarian movement as a strain, which is sort of Oxford movement. Mm-hmm. Is it Pusey? And John Henry Newman. But the key thing with that is they associate the problems of this sort of terrible conditions of the working poor
with the loss of religion.
With the loss of religion and the loss of the sort of spirituality of Catholic unified, you know, the charity of monasteries, the colour, inspiration of life. Everything is being driven by mechanics and profits and all that sort of stuff. That's a big strain. And they're the people who start building Gothic churches and things.
I think it can be easy to see people wanting to abolish slavery and think, therefore, that these people are predominantly kind of liberal in their inclination, and they're really not.
It's a mixed, funny mixed bag.
You know, there's John Stuart Mill and people like that who are around, but actually, it's very strongly moralistic in its kind of tenor. One of the big figures and someone who had a big influence on Ruskin is Thomas Carlyle, who's a really kind of a social... He's a sort of a social reformer.
Although I think a lot of what you'd get in your mind when you said that wouldn't be useful for understanding. Yeah.
No, I'm going to go into it. But I mean, so he's someone who at one level is sort of animated by outrage at the condition of the poor, the sort of conditions in the new mechanized economy. And he tries also to theorize what a conceptual level is wrong with that, so that he theorizes that what's wrong is to do with what he calls the cash nexus, the fact that all social relations between employers and employees and different people are now mediated entirely by cash, by paying, by buying and selling people's labor. And so he's sort of at one level talking about something which you could sort of think a little bit like the kind of the condition of alienation from labour and from each other, which you would get in a sort of more Marxian analysis. At another level, there are very different things going on. So his answers are in this way sort of profoundly animated by faith and by nostalgia, by a kind of imagined nostalgia for the pre-bourgeois, the pre-capitalist, the era of people living on the land, the reciprocal bond between the lord and his feudal serfs, so that they worked, their condition of life was very circumscribed, they were forced to carry out the work for which they were fit, but at the same time he also owed, you know, noblesse oblige, he owed them also kind of to look after them and to ensure that they were protected and that they were able to in the kind of idealized form. There's a sort of reciprocal relationship between the lord and his serfs. So Carlyle is not in favour of hereditary aristocracy, which he thinks has very clearly run its course and is kind of foppish and degraded and ridiculous. But he is someone who believes very profoundly in the role of great men in history.
Heroes.
Heroes. And one of his big studies is the people that he identifies. So Cromwell is one. What was it? Meister Wilhelm or someone, who's a person who I have no idea who he's talking about. He kind of does lectures on these. And what he thinks what society needs is... And the real echoes here, I think, both of what we'll later come to know as fascism and also of the kind of weird sort of floaty sort of Geistig dream of people like Bruno Taut and that sort of particular strain within expressionist modernism. You should listen to those episodes if you feel inclined.
They're good, and by some margin the least listened to, for some reason.
So he sort of has the idea of kind of merit aristocracy.
The natural aristocracy, which is what, which is the sort of Greek idea of aristocracy as well.
So yeah, we need like a spiritual revolution which is going to strip away the dehumanizing aspects of mechanization and return us to a better age where people will be able to live out their sort of fullest lives by knowing exactly their station for the place for which they're best fit.
The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, made them hire lowly and commission their estate.
Well, it's not quite that. I think that's one of the things which is sort of mysterious, is how do people end up in these stations?
It is God-given. Well, that's what All Things Bright and Beautiful is about. It's God. God is commissioning this.
I mean, the other thing about Carlyle, which I think is very characteristic, is it's like a sermonizing form of writing. It's hectoring, it's rhetorical.
To read it now, it's very... Both him and Ruskin are both very different to the way we write now. It's like a rhetorical speech, and he's sets up these strange straw men all the time and gives them names, you know, Bumbly Bophulus, the devil, the dastardly banker, and sort of it will literally be, you know, he'll give them a silly name and then he'll have them voicing a travesty of their argument. You can say that this is what he's the sort of founder of, like the anti-Whig history of sort of Tory history, whereas Gibbon had said it's the great sort of mass of people interacting, create these sort of great impersonal forces which move history on like the weather, almost like waves. And his model is it is great men, and it basically is exclusively men, grand blanc, I mean, including Mohammed and probably Artaxerxes. And these shining lights are magnificent and inspire the worship of others, the worship of heroes, which is the natural condition of man and is the natural economic relationship, which is a feudalism based on the worship of heroic men whose dynamism and energy propels human progress. It's extraordinarily reactionary.
At one level, he seems to be identifying elements of the condition of like working under capitalism and what makes it dehumanizing. In place of social relations based on affection, it substitutes social relations based entirely on like cash exchange. But then at another level, yeah, he can't imagine any other way of society being led except by this kind of miraculous... this sort of miraculous charismatic leadership. So he's very down on trades unions, for example. One of his last things that he wrote was about how appalling it was to kind of, all they were doing was agitating for more money.
Yeah, these terrible people.
He can't conceive of kind of class conflict in that way.
And it's worth saying that's my weird, I wish it wasn't my sort of standard interjection. The notion sort of presiding before that was the Enlightenment that, in the Middle Ages, we had been presided over by utterly, even more so than in fact was true, dictatorial aristocrats whose word could have you killed and, you know, dragged off into slavery and misery, and that was being swept away by Enlightenment liberty, the liberty of England, the glorious revolution, doing away with these hideous privileges of magnates. And that was allowing the natural order, which is essentially middle class dominance, of England. And so it's not as if what he's saying is just stating the status quo. He's transgressively saying, no, actually, the tyranny of great men is the ideal condition, and that's really strange. He's overturning a status quo, which is about English liberty, the mixed constitution, parliamentary democracy, a polity in which the aristocracy and the king have some sort of mixed settlement, which is what the English have been very, very proud of before this point. It's a really weird argument, and Ruskin buys into it. Ruskin believes, certainly in The Stones of Venice and the stuff we're going to talk about, in natural aristocracy, and says so. He'll say things like, we will all work together and label to create things beautiful. Of course there will be nobles among us, as there will be in any natural society. But, you know, and so on.
And I mean, I think maybe probably on the next part we'll get the chance to talk a bit about his works on political economy. So I think there's a couple of other aspects. I know we've talked for almost an hour about context, but I think it's merited.
Ooh, there's one more I want to get in. I want to talk about rocks.
Yeah, so I think this is really important. So let's do a bit of Victorian science and what's going on.
Of the first half of the 19th century, the scientific revolution that breaks through into intellectual thought of everyone, the one that everyone's talking about, like in a way that at the end of the 20th century, everyone would talk about quantum theory or something as this, you know, people would... we're going to write a novel in the style of quantum theory.
Yeah, or Einsteinian
relativity
at its time, or
like,
whatever.
What are you interested in that Miss World is asked?
Yeah. I think it's amazing. Yeah. The bending of space-time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, people writing poems about it or whatever. Or, you know, like what now seems like a very weird contrivance, space-time and architecture, which is the sort of survey of modern architecture by Siegfried Gideon, which is sort of meant to be about Einsteinian relativity
but
as well.
But in the way that, like, Aldo Rossi is scientific, which is not at all. Yeah. The science that is that for the first half, the science in the late 19th century is probably evolution, but in the first half is definitely geology, which is overturning the old view of the world. There had been writers on geology in the sort of Renaissance period, people going down mines and noticing that there are strata of rocks. Mm-hmm. But in the 18th century, it starts to be that people do systematic geological maps. You start to get steam engines to pump out mines. It starts to get deep. It starts to become commercially important to realise where seams of rock are, and that means that the Geological Society of England produces enormous amounts of technical data. This creates arguments about how the rocks come into being. At the beginning of the 19th century, probably the prevailing idea is catastrophism, which is this radical idea that instead of the Earth being around on a biblical time frame, it's actually taken tens of thousands of years to come into being, the world as it exists
now.
And it's created by sort of biblical type catastrophes. There are great floods which lay down enormous amounts of material, catastrophic volcanoes which create, you know, Scotland's basalt fields are gone in one giant leap by this massive volcano, and this is a very shocking idea because it means that you need more time.
Yeah, biblical chronology is wrong.
But it sort of also fits into a lot of natural prejudices that you know, we are a society on the edge of some cataclysmic breakdown, which is always very popular. And you can sort of make it work, but, you know, perhaps they're the days of the Bible or something like that. And then... I'm sure a lot of people are doing it, but the one I know and the one who was very famous at the time, a man called Lyell, who I forget the first name of, publishes a book called The Principles of Geology, I think at the beginning of the 1830s. And he successfully manages to push this notion that it's the opposite of that. Actually, the world may have been around for a couple of million years, and the process is everything is gradual. Everything progresses, it's sort of gradualism. What's it called? It's not called gradualism. Is it uniformitarianism? Catastrophism and uniformitarianism in geology? And this is the idea that everything is slowly sort of... Volcanoes slowly build up through tiny deposits, and the force of tiny deposits in the sea and the erosion of rivers... creates everything. And this becomes the really dominant view probably until Krakatoa explodes. He'd said that Pliny must have been an idiot. He says albatrosses have three testicles, and he says that Mount Vesuvius blew up. And we all know volcanoes don't blow up. They just slowly accrete.
Ah, yes. Then there was a revision.
Then there was an enormous explosion in an Indonesian island, which blew the entire island to pieces. And the people said, perhaps perhaps he's not completely right. But that was the view. And the significance of this for Ruskin, there's several significances. One of which is, this is interesting. People have looked at the natural world. You know, there's two good books in Christianity, aren't there? There's the Bible and there's nature. And people have looked at nature and they have seen what God hath wrought. And we have now seen how God has created these amazing bending, twisting rocks. And Ruskin would stare and look at them for hours and hours and paint them in amazing detail, these sort of swirling sedimentary patterns. That this process could be done by sort of man's intellect alone, based on methodically mapping out geology, examining it through strata, and then from that to be able to extrapolate this whole world of information scientifically, I think he thinks is amazing. And I think loads of people thought this was amazing. And then that would overturn the notion of historic time. Yeah. Before this point, people's view of history was sort of, in England, well, there were the Druids for a couple of hundred years, and then, you know, so maybe going back to what we'd call like 500 BC, and then Caesar in, and maybe some Greeks came up, and then Caesar invades, and then we're off to the races. And that at the same time as this geological notion, that there's also the notion of, there's a man in Denmark who creates the idea of the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age, which are probably each, in his mind, sort of 200 years old or 200 years long. And you're beginning to get this great expansion of time, which has really continued into the sort of 70s, I guess, when we started to measure, or even until like our own time, when we've used the cosmic microwave background to measure the period of time since the Big Bang. And it, I think, is very compelling and conflicting for him, because it tells you something about the nature of God. It tells you amazing things about the power of human wisdom and science and the process that he's interested in. He says, I could be a geologist. In a kind of, I could have been a contender way, all the way through his life, right from the beginning to the end. It's one of his regrets. And he spends loads of time in a rather amateurish way. But they were, I mean, Darwin, they were all amateurs, I suppose, the scientists of the age, looking at rocks.
He loves rocks, yeah.
But the way he loves them is different to Lyell.
He loves them kind of like beautiful creatures or something.
Yeah, the inside world and the outside world are the same. Like, he feels a sublime feeling, looks at a rock, the rock is God, the rock is man, nature, science.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, isn't it? So that there's the reconciliation that he makes between faith and science, or sort of naturalism, is this sort of intense aesthetic appreciation and study of nature as God's work. Which is something which you sort of see in modern painters and in the other books. They're full of, he's always sort of sketching and drawing and kind of working out.
But I think for him was very troubling as well. I don't know if it is him who's got the famous quote, now I open the Bible and at the end of every line I hear the tapping of geologists' hammers. And he's sort of imagining the whole edifice like being chipped away by these, we should look it up because it might be Ruskin. But I think also he had a crisis of faith and went insane sort of after his great period. And I think geology was an important part of his crisis of faith. We'll talk about that in the second episode because it's very important for his later attitudes.
Yes. Yeah, you're quite right. If only the geologists would let me alone, I could do very well. But those dreadful hammers, I hear the clink of them at the end of every cadence of the Bible verses.
It's good. I imagine it like the bells. The bells, the bells. Clink, 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 you know. Yes. And yeah, I don't think you can underestimate how much of his life, rather with Charles Darwin and barnacles, how much of his life he gave over to looking at rocks, writing about rocks, painting rocks, thinking about rocks. It's as much time, I think, as he spent thinking about architecture, as much time as he thought about thinking about society and labour, he spent thinking about stones, rocks and boulders. Just got to be able to wrap your head around why. And I think it's their sublime romantic quality. He was a romantic. Go out into nature. Terribilita. The power of these rocks. They're imprinted with God. They're scientific. I think if you can get your head around how all those things can be together, in a way you're getting into the sort of Ruskin way of thinking.
The other really key piece of context about Ruskin and where he's coming from is that he's a Londoner and he is a child of Georgian London, Although, as you say, he did spend time away in these various sort of genteel towns out in the fresh air. His family home was on Brunswick Square, which is sort of East Bloomsbury, and which I think may have been demolished to make way for the Brunswick Centre.
It was bombed out. It was genuinely bombed out. But I think it's the square on the side, isn't it? So a bit of it remains and a bit was destroyed.
For non-Londoners, it's this rather unlikely 60s sort of megastructure which pops up in the middle of, or on the sort of the edge of the Bedford Estate and all of these. So Georgian London and what it was like, I think, is something important to get your head around, not least because in the present day it's so extensively idealised, and I think it's quite important to try and understand what a person might really dislike about it, or why there might be a great revolution in taste against it, which Ruskin was very much part of.
Like aesthetically rather than just economically. A lot of people would say the economic system and that was embodied by it is horrible, exclusionary and...
Yeah, sure. Certainly in Ruskin, the aesthetic, the moral, the social are all very much kind of implicated in each other. You can't really separate them out. As you say, there'd been the big population expansion, there'd been a huge expansion of London, predominantly, well, it expanded in all directions, but in particular, and this is the part that he lived in, it expanded out to the west of the historic city.
The expansion is like from sort of 1600 to 1900, it expands by like a factor of 120 or something.
Because he makes specific reference to Georgian London as... Georgian London in the Stones of Venice is a sort of symbol of where architecture and urbanism, to the extent that it kind of existed as a category then, had gone wrong. It's a sort of symbol of degradation. And in his remarks on the Renaissance, he talks about the sort of the post-Gothic in architecture as that which has transported architecture from the glories of the Grand Canal to Gower Street, which is this long north-south artery in the Bedford Estate.
But now these houses are worth like 10 million quid at least. Yeah. And
yeah, people love them now. And I think you've got to try and get your head around what in his mind would be wrong with them. So the form of development is that they're terraces on streets and squares. They're laid out, and I'm talking particularly about the stuff to the west on the great estates. So these are like the big estates of aristocrats, which would be laid out with streets and squares. The development in other directions is more piecemeal than it is towards where he's living. They would have a plan. The plan would be laid out. The houses would be built and in its original form, what would happen is that someone would lease the plot, they would build their own house and fit it out, and then they could live in it, and they would pay like a ground rent to the landowner. What happens quite quickly is that you start to get people speculating, so kind of becoming an intermediary in that process where they lease the plot. Often they do like a little deal to not pay anything up front. And then they build the house and then they sell the house on to the kind of person who wants it. And the nature of the architecture is that, at least around there, it is coming out of like Palladian architecture. It's intended to be kind of classical in its proportions, although that sort of goes out to a greater or lesser extent. It's made of brick. It places a high value on sort of symmetry and order over any kind of expression of difference. So even though you'd be building your own house, there were very strict rules about how it had to be, at least on the front. But then also, because it's got this speculative character at every level, you know, the landowner is just sort of selling off the plots to make money, or leasing them off to make money, and there are often like builders who are getting in there to make their share. So the way in which they're realised, it really depends a lot on the quality of the builder.
If you go to the squares, you can really see this. In the high period, the classic development would be a new block's going to be opened up. At the centre, there's a square, which has got the grandest houses. And then there's a pattern book of five or six types of house, which are defined essentially by their ground floor plan and an elevation. That would be sold off, as you say, like in groups of five or six.
constructed builders. And you can sort of see if you go around the squares, there's five or six that are sort of slightly shorter or slightly differently proportioned. And the whole thing on the square would often be done to sort of semi-resemble a grand palace with a sort of central building. And then off that, that pretense is kind of gradually eroded until you're getting into little sort of side streets and back streets with gradually smaller but still very grand houses. And then eventually the muses at the back with little tiny sort of servant houses.
And there are bits which are not worked out. So often, depending on the quality of the building, the sort of gable condition or the way in which it turns a corner may either be very well resolved or very kind of capably sort of made to look like a pavilion, sort of bringing the terrace to an end, or it may be a total bodge with lots of like blind windows and weirdly articulated
things. There's a real
things.
Difference between some of the early estates, which are often an absolute mess, and sort of John Nash, who will really, who will be kind of artful in the way that he commercially lays things out for maximum profit.
One of the things about Georgian London is that it's certainly in my view, it's like vastly improved by having been sort of selectively destroyed by the depredations of time, development and war. Yeah, so I think it would have presented as like this incredibly uniform, like kind of plain, rather boring, kind of machine-like quality to the eye and to walk around. I think also that they, in some way, they like literalize the way in which cash is governing everything in the society as well, because I imagine even then you would have, because they were built unevenly, so you'd have the ones which are just like the walls have come up to 1 foot or something and it's stopped and they're waiting for someone to come along. It would all, there'd be kind of unevenness around the edges. There'd be, and then around the further out of town you would reach like wherever the kind of onrushing wave of successive Georgian developments, which are sort of broadly following in slightly more reduced kind of plan, the same sort of model.
And it's madly, madly hierarchical as well. It's, you've got the aristocracy coming down for the season who'd have the big houses on the squares, the sort of 20 or 30 English families that seem to own everything. And then the sort of the haute bourgeois battling funny games where they might live on various of the streets. And the houses literally are graded by rank. And everything's on 99-year leases, which a lot of it still is. That's what the way they'd sell off the whole block in 99. It's basically, I mean, so much of it is the Bedford Estate, which is a aristocrat at the dissolution of the monasteries, got the Cistercian convent's land, and that's the land from Covent Garden, which is the convent, to King's Cross.
They're all, and also, I mean, actually those great estates give their names to all of these places, like Camden is the Lord, Somerstown is Lord Somers. Yeah, they're all the, what he's seeing around him is a London which sort of speaks to a kind of dehumanized age in which people's capacity to express themselves through architecture is like radically curtailed, and also in which all anyone cares about are these kind of like hollow sort of status symbols. And I think also, like, to the extent that they have decoration or they have other things, they're sort of pre-cast like fake stone things which are stuck on or whatever, yeah, which is all.
The other buildings were the early great commercial buildings of the city, the Bank of England, the Royal Exchange, and the beginnings of the great industrial buildings, the first of the railway stations and the bridges of the city. All of them are marked by a much more austere, mechanical, commercial,
soulless,
and something dreadful. They're just not covered at all in lapis lazuli and gold.
They most certainly are not. Right, so I think we're almost there, but we should talk about the book about architecture which he wrote before Stones of Venice, which is The Seven Lamps of Architecture,
which I think sold really well, and I think many more people actually read than The Stones of Venice.
So that's from 1849. He was about 30.
Yep, and had already started, when that came out, he'd already started writing The Stones of Venice.
And the idea of seven lamps is that they are the sort of the what should be the guiding influences, kind of abstract concepts, guiding architecture, guiding good
Illuminating
architecture.
Illuminating principles. often represented, this is often represented like a menorah.
And they are respectively sacrifice, truth, power, beauty, life, memory, and obedience.
He's got them on his tombstone.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's illustrated in a way which is was going to become quite familiar, which is this sort of highly fragmentary bits of good buildings, but which might be very small or might be something quite big, and which are often kind of taxonomic. So he'll have Gothic windows and he'll have sort of 20 different examples on a black background.
He loves a numbered list. As you can see with the numbered list of virtues, but it will then break down part one, and then that will be one of the things, and then that will be a numbered list, which will have a numbered list of building components.
I mean, this is another one which seems to be where the impulse for writing, it seems to be animated by someone else being wrong. He's constantly making reference to this guy called Wood, the architect, who's written a description of his travels in Italy, and who keeps saying stupid things.
Never heard of him.
No, I don't think we need to look him up, but it's just funny how much it comes up. He's like, and then he says this, and let me tell you, like, I don't know how much there is to say about it, really, but I mean, it's...
I haven't read it at all. I meant to, but I haven't got around to it.
Yeah, so he has this kind of aphorism about, well, so the lamp of sacrifice, one of the things he's objecting to is the fact that people build, that if you're going to build a building, it needs to be the best that it can possibly be. It can't just be the thing which you happen to be able to afford. All old work has been hard work. It may be the hard work of children or barbarians or rustics, but it is always their utmost. Ours has, as constantly, the look of money's worth, of a stopping short wherever and whenever we can, of a lazy compliance with low conditions, never of a fair putting forth of our strength. Which I think, you know, you can certainly imagine that being kind of directed at the sort of environs that he would have grown up in London, and it's also very characteristically making this connection with the aesthetic outcome of architecture mapping onto the kind of innate moral virtue of those who are producing it.
Do you think you could tell me what the seven lamps mean in turn?
So sacrifice is, well, it's that thing which I've just mentioned. It's, you know, the thing of doing your utmost, of a kind of dedication to craft in the abstract rather than as a sort of instrumentalized kind of response to...
Like
to,
a labor of love?
Yeah, exactly. Or like, everything should be a labor of love.
Or like a vocation?
You can see that there's an overlap there with obedience as well, which is also about doing things well, kind of against...
I'm going to ask you them in order. Okay. Truth, so what's that?
Truth is, they're all very vague. Truth has an element of being true to materials. If you're going to do facing, like outward facing of things...
Encrustation,
as we'll get on to. It can't be... There's a sort of fakery which he's against, which is like if you put like brick slips, he would be very down on. So putting like stone facings on the outside of bricks. It's okay for things which are extremely precious and which would not be possible to use in any other way. So you don't have to build out of load-bearing lapis lazuli.
His favourite material, actually, whenever he's talking really about something good or a good time, everything is encrusted in gold. It has a feel to me of, like, the structural honesty of concrete modernism.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think that that's a similar sort of spirit.
Power. So what does power mean?
Power is about how architecture moves us. It's about sort of architectural sublimity. And it's about things moving us either through being extremely forceful, drawing on natural examples, or through being extremely delicate and inspiring kind of pathos.
It's really powerful, like a really tall Gothic church.
Yeah, so it could be like a very tall tower. It could be that kind of that kind of effect. But talking about where that effect comes from, which is from the natural.
Beauty.
Beauty.
What does he mean
I
by
think
beauty?
Beauty is something I think we're going to return to later in terms of ornament.
All of these we're going to talk about more.
Yeah. So beauty is, I think refers to legitimate sources of inspiration, which are nature.
Well, he's got a general thing. Everything that's good comes from God. And everything that's not good comes from original sin. Because man can do both good and bad, but he's a flawed being. Ruskin believes that all the clouds in the sky have been carefully and studiously arranged by God's hand to look the best they possibly could. He believes that when you sit on a beach, God has timed all the waves and their powers for maximum aesthetic potential. And he sort of suggests that the reason why some drawings are bad is because people draw them willy-nilly, as if they were just scattered about by chance, when really they have been arranged by God for maximum effect. Anyway, life.
So life, I think, is about work. So it's about the condition of the life of the craftsman making the work. And it refers to an idea which we're going to be seeing again, although probably, I think probably in the next episode mostly, which is that it's critically important under what conditions and with what kind of sort of volitional relationship to the work the workman is engaged. He is totally against the idea that the architect gets to design everything, and he thinks that part of the reason why modern buildings are so lifeless is that sort of spatial and aesthetic effect has been entirely annexed by the designer.
And I think that's also the same thing as beauty, because I think man, if he can tap into the godliness of himself, which is actually the unconscious, it's our decisions which make us wrong, that's sort of original sin. But underneath it all, he says, for every rich man, it is pleasurable to give away money, but they don't know it. They are trapped by their knowledge. And for every hand, I think, he feels that fundamentally, sort of subconsciously, there is goodness. Yeah. And that learning and rigour will corrupt it. But he doesn't believe it will come out like unpracticed as well. It's this complicated notion.
He has this kind of idea of the sort of unfeigned and idealistic sort of enthusiasm of the worker for the subject that they're representing. You know, if they're carving a capital with some kind of leaf detail on it, then it's their innate love and delight in the beauty of the oak or the laurel or the acanthus or whatever it happens to be, which is going to charge it with real aesthetic effect.
Right, and now here's another one, interesting one, memory.
So memory, and this is something which I think we'll probably return to in the bonus, is, among other things, to do with the impossibility of restoration, as it was understood in the 19th century. So the idea, we won't go into this in detail, but there was an idea at that time that it was a kind of good and dutiful thing to do to restore a building to its original condition, so that in the case of a church of the 12th century or something, that you might strip away all the things which had happened to it and to place it back into its kind of original and unsullied state. And he says that it is impossible to restore a building, that you can only create fakery, and that to restore is to destroy. And so that you therefore need to acknowledge everything which has happened in the history of a building, and that you need to the extent that you are adding anything to it, you kind of have to add honestly and, you know, in the same sort of spirit that we've already described.
In a kind of creative way, and like we think now. Does it have anything also to do with, like, if you're a Lombard, you should build Lombard?
Yeah, sure. I think that's part of it. So, I mean, in the case of his kind of propositional English Gothic, what's that going to have? We certainly shouldn't have any kind of fakery of adopting kind of French...
Heaven forbid!
...forms or whatever. Or, you know, these kind of, you know, beautiful though the acanthus capital is, or beautiful though the sort of the foliation of the Byzantine capital might be, an English Gothic is going to need to draw on the sturdy oak, you know, all of these kind of...
Heart of the forest, the greenwood tree. Finally, obedience.
I can't really remember what that's about.
It says on the Wikipedia page, no originality for its own sake.
Well, I think obedience may have something to do with what we were just talking about then. I think that obedience may also be about the nature of being true to what you are and where you are.
Well, I think we should end with... He'd finished writing the book, and before it came out...
Yeah.
He, having just got married, left with his wife to go on a long study trip to Venice. His father was against it. He wanted him to write a new volume of modern painters, having been rather sad that he didn't become a poet. And he felt terrific pressure from his father, who also paid for everything, obviously. And going to Venice meant employing a couple of valets to make sure he didn't get into too much trouble and making sure he'd be fed. But his wife was rather for it because there was rather hope that that might make... We'll go into the situation of their relationship, but there was some hope that that would be better. And eventually he won his father round. Also, the war that was going on in Vienna, Venice at that time finished, and more or less... A few weeks after it finished, he packed his bags and was off. And took the normal route through France, down the Rhone, over the Alps, into northern Italy, and arrived. The railway station had been blown up, and set about his great study, spending 6 months in the first period, I think, his great study of the stones of Venice. And it really is the stones. He's mainly looking at features of the buildings, and that becomes the study of Venice and so much more. And that's what we're gonna get onto next time. We've slightly run out of steam, but I think we're prepped up.
We've got you into the mid-19th century.
We shouldn't keep you from your gondola. We were gonna put this at the end of the next episode, but I think we can do it now. It's a little bit out of time.
This is the end of the first volume. Not to give too much away, but it's rather a relief when you get there.
You can read it as a story of a journey from Padua to the shores of Venice that he took in 1849. He's about to approach the city of wonder, which he's going to devote the next few years of his life. And it's a city which has just suffered terribly from... There was a rebellion, a successful rebellion against the Austrians for their freedom, which lasted for a year, and the city has just had to submit after many months of siege and shelling to the Austrians taking over again. Almost as soon as they get in, Ruskin comes in after them and begins his great work of nostalgia. And anyway, we can just get into the story. It'll be quite long.
And now come with me, for I have kept you too long from your gondola. Come with me on an autumnal morning through the dark gates of Padua, and let us take the broad road leading towards the east. It lies level for a league or two between its elms and vine festoons full laden, their thin leaves veined into scarlet hectic and their clusters deepened into gloomy blue. Then mounts an embankment above the Brenta and runs between the river and the broad plain, which stretches to the north in endless lines of mulberry and maize. The Brenta flows slowly but strongly, a muddy volume of yellowish-grey water that neither hastens nor slackens but glides heavily between its monotonous banks, with here and there a short babbling eddy twisted for an instant into its opaque surface and vanishing as if something had been dragged into it and gone down. Presently you pass one of the much vaunted villas on the Brenta, a glaring spectral shell of brick and stucco, its windows with painted architraves like picture frames, and a courtyard paved with pebbles in front of it, all burning in the thick glow of the feverish sunshine, but fenced from the high road for magnificence's sake, with goodly posts and chains. Then another of Kew Gothic, with Chinese variations, painted red and green. A third, composed for the greater part of dead wall, with fictitious windows painted upon it, each with a pea-green blind and classical architrave, in bad perspective. And a fourth, with stucco figures set on top of its garden wall, some antique, like the kind to be seen at the corner of the new road. This is the architecture to which her studies of the Renaissance have conducted modern Italy. The sun climbs steadily and warms into intense white.
the walls of the little Piazza of Dorlor, where we change horses. Another dreary stage among the now divided branches of the Brenta, forming irregular and half-stagnant canals, with one or two more villas on the other side of them. But these are of the old Venetian type, which we may have recognised before at Padua, and sinking fast into utter ruin, black and rent and lonely, set close to the edge of the dull water, with what were once small gardens beside them, kneaded into mud, and with blighted fragments of gnarled hedges and broken stakes for their fencing, and here and there, a few fragments of marble steps which have once given them graceful access from the water's edge, now setting into the mud and broken joints. 5 minutes more, and we are in the upper room of the little inn at Mestre, glad of a moment's rest in shade. The table is, always I think, covered with a cloth of nominal white and perennial grey, with plates and glasses at due intervals, and small loaves of peculiar white bread made with oil, and more like knots of flour than bread. The view from its balcony is not cheerful. A narrow street, with a solitary brick church and barren campanile on the other side of it, and some convent buildings, with a few crimson remnants of fresco about their windows, and, between them and the street, a ditch with some slow current in it, and one or two small houses beside it, one with an arbour of roses at its door as in an English tea garden, the air, however, about us having in it nothing of roses, but a close smell of garlic and crabs, warmed by the smoke of various stands of hot chestnuts. There is much vociferation also going on beneath the window respecting certain wheelbarrows, which are in rivalry for our baggage. We appease them with our best patience and follow them down the narrow street. But walk some 200 yards when we come to a low wharf or quay at the extremity of a canal with long steps on each side down to the water, which latter we fancy for an instant has become black. Another glance undeceives us. It is covered with the black boats of Venice. We enter one of them, rather to try if they be real boats or not than with any definite purpose, and glide away, at first feeling as if the water were yielding continually beneath the boat and letting her sink into soft vacancy. It is something clearer than any water we have seen lately, and of a pale green, the banks only 2 or 3 feet above it of mud and rank grass, with here and there a stunted tree, gliding swiftly past the small casement of the gondola as if they were dragged by upon a painted scene. Stroke by stroke, we count the plunges of the oar, each heaving up the side of the boat slightly as her silver beak shoots forward. We lose patience and extricate ourselves from the cushions. The sea air blows keenly by as we stand leaning on the roof of the floating cell. In front, nothing to be seen but long canal and level bank. To the west, the tower of Mestre is lowering fast, and behind it there have risen purple shades of the colour of dead rose leaves all round the horizon, feebly defined against the afternoon sky. Forward still, the endless canal bends at last and then breaks into intricate angles about some low bastions now torn to pieces and staggering in ugly rents towards the water. Another turn, another perspective of the canal, but not interminable. The silver beak cleaves it fast. It widens. The rank grass of the bank sinks lower and lower, and at last dies in tawny knots along an expanse of weedy shore. Over it, on the right, but a few years back, we might have seen the lagoon stretching to the horizon, and the warm southern sky bending over Malamocco to the sea. Now, we can see nothing but what seems a low and monotonous dockyard wall with flat arches to let the tide through it. This is the railroad bridge, conspicuous above all things. But at the end of those dismal arches, there rises out of the wide water a struggling line of low, and confused brick buildings, which, but for the many towers which are mingled among them, might be the suburbs of an English manufacturing town. Four or five domes, pale, and apparently at a greater distance, rise over the centre of the line. But the object which first catches the eye is a sullen cloud of black smoke brooding over the north half of it, and which issues from the belfry of a church. It is Venice.